Welcome back. Bless Your Boys Podcast, bringing you the week in baseball news from a Detroit Tigers perspective. BlessYouBoys.com is your home for all things Detroit Tigers baseball on the SB Nation platform. Let us get the show on the road. All right, welcome back, everybody. We've got a couple special guests tonight. Just trying to survive the old coronavirus here and keep finding some ways to get some baseball discussion going without the baseball. We've got our buddy Mark Garage of the Don't Call It a Team Build podcast and Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic Detroit. I'm rusty at this myself right now. How are we doing tonight, gentlemen?
thanks for having me, B. Anything that there is to do I've exhausted every useful. I'm now watching some things on Netflix for the second and third time now. So.
Yeah. Yep. I feel you there. I've been rereading books and rewatching shows, trying to watch some new things. Whatever we can manage to keep things going. I figure we might even just talk about some of these things, like what we're doing to occupy ourselves. But let's kind of start off with the state of the situation here. I'm sure you guys all read Ken Rosenthal's article for The Athletic the other day, basically about the attempts to kind of game plan for a potential season. Any key takeaways from that you found there, Cody? How are you feeling about the odds that the league can put together some kind of half season without fans, if that's what it comes to?
Yeah, it's just so hard to know, and it seems like the prognosis is getting kind of grimmer by the day. What you wonder is that just our mindset right now. I think really we just can't predict. We're not going to have baseball in May. I don't know that we're going to have baseball in June. But if this curve flattens, if you look at some of the projections, I feel like there's a shot we could have a season probably with no fans in July, but that's just my guess, right? I don't know, and I'm not a medical professional, and really until we have the data and the numbers, I don't think we can make that determination. And I think that's probably why baseball is considering so many different options, so many different avenues. They want to kind of be ready for anything, but it does seem like Rob Manfred and the rest of Major League Baseball are making a pretty concerted effort to try to play, if at all possible, basically if state, local, national officials will allow it. I think they'd like to have a season, and it might end up being some of the best marketing MLB's gotten in a long time, if it can be done. The big question is just if, and if you read Ken Rosenthal's piece, there's a story in the Washington Post yesterday. The more you read, it really sounds to me like the idea of having fans in a stadium just probably isn't going to be feasible, but I sure hope I'm wrong.
Well, it just all comes down to, like you said, like we just don't really know. And the initial decisions that MLB all had to make were, of course, under extreme duress with, very, very low amount of information. And so it probably makes sense to, try to game plan for a lot of different scenarios. But there's just so many factors, from the fact that this is, this is an international situation, of course. And so, what Canada decides to do, can have some impact on the league. They're talking obviously about just trying to do this at a couple of stadiums, presumably maybe out in Arizona and using the spring training complex out there for something like that. It just seems really, really difficult because while we might get the curve flattening in New York and some of the hot spots might die down, we just don't know if it might continue to bubble up in the South or the Southwest, where we haven't quite seen it get so bad yet. Yeah, it's just, really one of those situations where all you can do is plan for a lot of different contingencies and hope for the best, I suppose. You're right.
Well, I think they have a few logistical issues that they have to hurdle, but once they did, there may be a way to see. There are some possibilities to being able to do this. There's basically 10 ballparks they could play in within the greater Phoenix area. Yeah. But first and foremost, it's conceivable 6 weeks from now that they could have testing that would allow them to identify players that have had it, players that haven't had it, if there's any way to take things that build up immunity. You know, obviously they're going to play in empty parks, but if there's 10 parks, you know, it tells you that you could easily play, you know, 15 games a day because you could, you know, play some in the afternoon, some in the evening. And I can promise you that the television networks, especially in the summertime, are going to go insane loving the idea that they could broadcast games.
Yeah.
So I don't have any idea the financial remuneration. They'll have to modify, obviously, an existing contract, but there's probably a good way to do that. And if they have testing and they can make sure that, you know, people that, you know, the players, the trainers, management, stadium workers, people that have to drive them to and from games, all the logistical individuals that are involved in getting, you know, 60 players to a game, because the rosters are going to be, you know, it's going to be 60 to 70 people between, you know, coaches and associated players. You have to be able to figure out how to protect them from becoming infected. So I would imagine it would be a nightmare trying to figure out how to house, you know, 1,400 people that would be there playing Major League Baseball for essentially 2 months. But
you're going to need to kind of isolate all those people, the umps, you know, the coaches, the players, their families, possibly.
But I think that we're discounting how much further along certain testing and treatment methodologies will be 60 days from now. And because just think of how much, how many innovations they've started to discuss in just the last 14 days. You know, in the next 30, I'm sure there's going to be quite a few. I mean, I talked to I have a relative that runs Ascension Hospitals in the state of Michigan, all 18 hospitals, and he was explaining, you know, they basically now have a test that, you know, for especially the workers that, you know, obviously it's been in the news quite a bit recently that, you know, there's going to be, the testing protocol is going to be much quicker and much more accurate, and it's only going to improve. So it's not an impossibility. Logistically, it will not be simple, but I don't think it will be impossible. The other thing that's really interesting about Phoenix is because it's such a tourism-oriented city, there's probably more housing available than you might think. So it's, you know, you can rent a house in Phoenix probably pretty easy.
Well, the question, and at a certain point, that's, you know, that's just gonna be a monetary thing, like you know, and the league has plenty of money. I'm sure, you know, that will probably not be one of the one of the tougher things to solve. I mean, it just all comes down to testing, really, doesn't it? This is all about uncertainty. The lack of any clarity has been the hardest thing to deal with all the way along through this thing. And hopefully, you know, we're obviously, you know, we've been behind and everything, but hopefully in a month or two, there'll be enough testing and readily available testing that they can at least kind of keep, you know, keep tabs on the players and everyone else involved. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there's some hope there. I would agree.
What would you guys, if you, you know, on a percentage speculation, we've done this a few podcasts in the last few weeks, and you know, the dates keep getting pushed out. We're already far beyond my initial projection, but what, on a percentage basis, what do you guys think the likelihood that they're able to start some modified form of a season up, say, 4th of July? What do you think the percentage is, likelihood?
Yeah, I think 2 weeks ago I would have said 90%, and I think now I would say, I don't know, 30, 40.
Yeah, I've been kind of saying July 1st or 4th, you know, all along, and yeah, I'm starting to think it's less likely, but as you say, not impossible. It's just, the problem is that once you know when you can go, you're still going to need at least a month, I would imagine, to sort of put the whole thing together once you have a timetable.
Absolutely.
And we're probably, it's hard to imagine us having a timetable until, late late May, mid-May, maybe something like that. We'll have a decent idea. So I don't know, and maybe you can extend things into the, you know, maybe you can extend things further into the fall and make something work. I'm not sure.
I mean, I kind of love the idea of having a 90 or 100 game sprint to the finish. I think it's cool as hell. Makes all the games get pretty meaningful pretty quickly. So,
well, and you're also going to have, you know, expanded rosters. So, you know, teams that have, you know, perhaps more ready-made, you know, starting pitching or bullpen help ready in the upper minors. There might be an advantage there. Like, yeah, there's going to be some interesting, you know, things to think about as far as, you know, what the gameplay is going to be like.
When else has baseball ever had a captive audience and they should be trying to figure out a way how to make it as much fun as humanly possible? That's my theory. So, because I'm not so sure they're going to be people sitting in football stadiums either. So,
yeah,
it's there's a lot of what ifs going on here, but I think baseball has a huge opportunity if the testing allows for them to, you know, create a playing environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I think you make a good point, Mark, about how much fun this could be if it gets off the ground. Like, imagine a July 4th opening day. Imagine a 100-game season where everybody's in it, you know? Even if you follow the Detroit Tigers, you're going to have a couple months at least where you're not totally out of it.
Right.
It's going, so I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the Tigers, you know, the Tigers have a knack for coming out, you know, red hot for the first, you know, 2-3 weeks of the season. So, yeah, you could be into this, you know, we could be into it into September.
But imagine if you were able to be like, you know, look, baseball, it happens every year the same way. There's going to be teams after 40 games that are 17 and 23, that you like the Yankees, that you thought were going to be great, right? And then who says a team like the Tigers can't be 20 and 20 after 40 games? And now if you're 20 and 20 after 40 games and they have some weird expanded playoff format, how do you not start saying to yourself, well, what can we do to make this more fun? Maybe, you know, let's take a shot. And you at least hope they would do that. They don't have to go out and mortgage anything of their future, but it would probably, you know, make you want to give some consideration to fast-tracking some of your kid arms and try to figure out how to piggyback them or something. Heck yeah, you would.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think the Tigers would do it. I think Oliveira would gladly do it if they felt they were in some level of contention. Yeah, I don't think they'd make trades or anything ridiculous. Would there even be a trade deadline? You know, that's a question.
No.
So,
yeah, maybe I think after 70 games they probably would go, look, okay, you know, no trades, you know, they figure out whatever the equivalent corresponding date to something like that, you know.
So
here's the other crazy ass question: what do you do with the minor leagues? Are you gonna let minor leagues play in empty stadiums, or are you gonna send them all to Florida? What the heck are you gonna do there?
Well, that's a question I really want to get into it with Cody, as far as, like, you know, some of the things you saw in the spring. But real quick, does anyone remember the game that the Orioles played a couple years ago where, you know, there was some unrest in Baltimore and they played to an empty stadium? Did anybody watch that game?
It was really odd.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I could see it, you know, I could see it working, but I keep having these visuals of, like, an empty stadium and, you know, Joe Buck trying to, trying to talk over the silence, you know, as opposed to the excitement that he's usually toning down. The whole thing it'll be strange, but, you know, we're all so hungry for baseball. I don't care about that at this point. That'd be totally fine. But yeah, Cody, do you have any idea what's going on with the minor leaguers right now? I assume guys are training at home, but what do you feel about the impact of them losing a couple months of development time here?
Yeah, I mean, we spend so much time talking about the major leagues, and that's complicated. And then you go to the minor leagues, and it's just like, wow, it's incredible. Not only are these guys losing what's probably important developmental time, you know, the guys who don't have big bonuses obviously are losing money. You have guys stocking shelves and stuff right now. looking for work, even though the league has finally taken some measures to keep some paychecks coming their way. It's not an easy time.
So
as far as I know, most of the vast majority of these guys, Tiger system, are back home. And that's probably tough on a rebuilding team like the Tigers, as much as I think it could actually improve the chances of a guy like Casey Mize debuting if there's a season this year. I mean, you want these guys getting innings in AAA right now, and that's not going to happen. Instead, they're, throwing a bullpen in their like garage or something like that. I mean, it's really weird, and I think the league is devoting so much of its efforts to sort things out at the MLB level. You know, it's easy for these minor league guys to kind of get forgotten about, and then you raise the question. Okay, say you have a major league season. Can you have a minor league season? I don't know the answer to that one. It'd be tough, even tougher to pull off. There's not as much money. It'd be harder to keep those guys isolated, harder to keep them safe. It's another huge concern. I wouldn't think it would be a fun time to be a player in the low-level minors, especially a guy who doesn't have a big signing bonus. It's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Even before the current situation, you know, the lower level guys are already kind of under assault. I mean, you know, we've been talking since the end of last season about the plans to contract the minor leagues, and you know, the fact that any pay raises that come to the minor leaguers are most likely, you know, going to be the result of them cutting a lot of the lower level guys out. So yeah, it's a real tricky time.
This might accelerate that movement, you know. If there's no minor league season or a shortened one, I think that will give them a little more credence or make it a little more easier for Major League Baseball to say, hey, let's cut 40 minor league affiliates in a year or two from now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cover available right now to do a lot of the things that they were going to do already that weren't very popular to a lot of people. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of the way it goes, unfortunately, in a situation like this. Not that we have that much experience with something quite like this, but yeah, you know, it just feels like they're gonna take that opportunity to cut those guys out right now. And yeah, you know, for a rebuilding team, it's hard to, you know, I don't want to say that it's harder on a rebuilding team than it is on, you know, a team that thought they were going to win the World Series and now have to kind of deal with all this uncertainty, like the Yankees or Astros, etc. But it does present some weird challenges and seems to turn the timetable back on a lot of guys, because, you know, it's not just developmental time, obviously, for hitters, but for the starting pitchers especially, it's that progression in workload and innings that is just going to, you know, it's just going to be impossible. That's already shot this year. So, yeah, there's a lot of unique challenges involved there for sure.
Well, I think that investigative journalist Cody Stavenhagen needs to start using some of his resources and talk to some of the people at The Athletic and find out what the answer is on that minor league question, because I think it's a hell of a question. Okay, what team is going to suffer from that more than the Detroit Tigers? That's just a nightmare scenario for the Tigers, having minor leaguers losing an entire year of development. That's just what a nightmare that's got to be for them. So I'd be curious what the plans are of, I mean, I could easily understand assembling a game plan to play major league games. There's way too much money in it. For sure, the players are into it. They want their damn money. They're getting paid, you know, ridiculous amounts of money. You know, I mean, Miguel Cabrera, I think, if I'm not, my math is good, he makes almost $200,000 a game. So if I was Miguel, I'd want to make sure we played some baseball. But, you know, these minor league guys, that's just a whole different set of logistics. And where would you play it? And how do you play it? You don't have TV money fueling it. It's a weird,
yeah, I mean,
it's a really weird question.
Yeah, minor league baseball is funded entirely, you know, like an amusement park, you know, basically at the minor league level for the affiliate, and without the stadium and the concessions and ticket sales and all that, there really is no minor league baseball. So Yeah, I don't know. That's going to be a touchy subject. I wonder if there's some way they could do something where you wouldn't have to burn an option, but you could use, you know, your top prospects somehow. Like, to get your best guys at least some game experience sometime this year. I'm not sure how that would work. And obviously the MLBPA, you know, would be in charge of that, and of course they'd be negotiating about the rights of guys who aren't, you know, aren't their clients yet. So that never seems to work out well for anyone.
That's the thing. Like, we're just now, you know, getting to the surface. There's so many ripples of all this. Are there teams like the Tigers, or teams in even smaller markets that would not call up a prospect because theoretically you then have to pay that guy more, and you don't have any gate revenue, you don't have any concession revenue. I mean,
yeah.
Every team, even though they're very wealthy, they're going to be hurting financially. And then those that tend to pinch pennies, that could influence some roster decisions as well.
Yeah, this is all going to kind of, you know, only further the sort of Astrosification of Major League Baseball, the corporatization of Major League Baseball, where they're trying to be, you know, incredibly efficient with their spending at levels that most fans don't even think about. In terms of their development staff, their scouting, all that stuff. So, yeah, the fallout here is going to be, you know, drastic and far-reaching, and it's probably not something we can really unpack to much degree yet.
Well, I think all this is paradigm-changing for the game. I mean, the game is by far been the slowest-moving sport in America at getting in, you know, moving forward, tweaking the rules, tweaking the way how they do things. I mean, obviously, with the advent of all this technology in the last 5 years, it's totally changed 100% how you evaluate players. I mean, there's no discussion about that. But the fact that you can now do all these things, and, you know, you're getting ready. This now you lose a year of development for the Robo Strike Zone, which I have probably in the minority, but, you know, I'm hugely in favor of it. I like the consistency. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm in favor of it.
I like the consistency of every park. It's a strike, same pitch, same times every day of the season. There's no arguing. It's not the guy, you know, had a bad night the night before and he missed two pitches right in the middle of the sequence that changes. There's all that stuff's got to stop. And yes, I understand that technology needs to be retrofitted and. I'm not saying it's a go until Harry Pavlidis tells me it's a go. That's been my theory for a few years. And when people like Harry say we're good to go and we've come up with a compromise where everybody can live with what's a strike and what's a ball, then it's probably a time, you know, I'll be looking forward to that day. But the point is, the game has a huge opportunity here to move itself forward with technology, with some expanded rosters, within the way they play it. How they promote it. They're going to find out a few things, and, you know, hopefully they take advantage of it. You know, historically they've been very, very slow to change. Look at other sports. I mean, you know, hockey's taken out the red line. They've changed overtime. The NBA isn't even remotely close to what it was 25 years ago in the way they play the game. Football, they've changed hash marks. They've changed overtime. They've changed rosters. The style of play is totally different. Baseball's like, you know, it's like Cooperstown, man. It's only these last few years if things changed, and, you know, they weirdly have a huge opportunity to change things, and people are going to not like a lot of it, but, you know, with this strange season, maybe we see it as a precursor to them getting a little more progressive, a little more innovative, and start trying to figure out. I've never understood why you have a 25, now 26-man roster where you have two or three starting pitchers that are, you got the pitcher pitching tomorrow and the pitcher that pitched yesterday. What the heck are they active for? It's the craziest thing I ever heard of. I mean, look at hockey. Hockey has rosters. You have a certain, football, same thing. Basketball, the same thing. You have X amount of guys on your roster. This is who's active for this day. Okay?
It's true, but you know, baseball is, you know, pitching is so different. Like, nobody else, you know, injures themselves to the point that they can't play for 2 days, you know, every time that they go out there the way a starting pitcher does. You know, that's the job of a starting pitcher, basically. I mean, I take your point, though, for sure. It's just that for a long time, you know, baseball has, the selling point for baseball has been the traditionalism. And they've waited long enough now that I think you're right that there's no choice but to move forward in those things. But it's going to be a lot, you know, more of a whiplash, you know, than the other sports had as they change things, you know, incrementally over time. You know, baseball's has lived on tradition and sold tradition for, you know, in that sort of heartland, apple pie, et cetera, for so long that, you know, to really change that. And we, you know, obviously fans have had to put up with, you know, the development of metrics, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of older school fans who haven't been fans of all the changes in the game already. Well, I think you're right, and they're just going to have to get ready for it, because it's only going to go further in that direction. And yeah, if they're smart, they would take this opportunity to make those changes, because, you know, like I said, it's cover for a lot of things. You know, there you can find a reason to make a lot of different changes that don't even necessarily have anything to do with the COVID-19 problem at all. So, yeah, we're gonna see.
That's my point. They should take advantage of the effect. Hey, B, I hope I'm not stepping on here, but I wanted to ask Cody why the three of us always have been in favor, and I want to kind of get some insight on this because we talk about it all the time privately. But Code, when you were down there and you saw the things that Graham and Hubs brought to the table, at least you got to see it more than any of us did because you were there, you know, and I know you interviewed both of them, right?
Yeah, I did.
And so was it too early to start seeing if they were, you know, I would imagine the pitching side, you know, they had no problem getting buy-in from, you know, most of the pitchers down there. I would imagine they were loving the idea. I have no idea how much on the hitting side, but give me your impressions of, you know, if they were having impact, if people were buying into it, were veterans buying into it, and how you think that was going to play for them and was it going to help the team. I mean, nobody's, you know, there's very few teams that have been slower to adopt this entire thing than the Tigers, and I'm just curious if you thought it would have some impact.
Yeah, I definitely think it will have impact, but I also think Kenny Graham and Dan Hubbs, they're kind of in their infancy with their new player development roles. I think the few weeks I were down there, they were still getting to know guys, figure out. It's really kind of a daunting job if you think about that. I don't know if you ask Kenny Graham that. Suddenly you are in charge of player development for every hitter in a system, and there's, you know, maybe some degree of a blueprint for how to do that, but it's also, it's kind of like a big sandbox. They want to formalize some things, but they're not going to go to a standard, you know, the one player called a blast motion swing and try to teach every guy in the organization the same swing. It's a very, you know, oversight-oriented job, and I think Kenny Graham for sure and probably Dan Hubbs too were probably treating spring training as get to know the players, their strengths, their weaknesses, what they're like as people. Maybe even more importantly, get to know the other coaches, because that's really who they oversee. Their job is to coach these other coaches in the Tigers system, teach them how to understand how to help a player improve through analytics, through technology, step in more directly if they need to. So I think it'll be fruitful. And as I've written before, it's really not totally fair or accurate to say that, oh, the Tigers are so far behind and antiquated. They certainly were, and they're just now catching up. But in terms of having the right people in place, I think with Graham and Hubs, you're a lot closer to that. I don't think there are very many teams out there that have any greater access to technology. They might be closer to that next breakthrough, but the Tigers have pretty much everything now. They're just behind on implementing it. So now the implementation begins. Pitchers definitely more easy to buy into. It helps having so many young guys rising through the system. Guys like Casey Mize, who probably already knows more about pitch design than almost anyone in the organization. Same with Matthew Boyd. Hitters are a little more reluctant for whatever reason. And maybe that's just the culture of hitting a little bit. And I will share this with you guys. I asked one player kind of what's it been like working with Kenny Graham so far. And he said, who? So that tells you a little bit. I don't necessarily think that's a knock on Kenny Graham or a knock on the Tigers. I think it tells you Kenny Graham's time has been spent with a lot more oversight so far, and they're not quite really digging in and getting to the nitty-gritty. That'll come in time, but it was a little early.
Yeah, and Kenny Graham's not the hitting coach. You know, yeah. Being the director of player development is a whole, you know, broader context type job where, yeah, right. I imagine getting familiar with the personnel, the front office, the analysts, the coaches, and trying to start to see what's there already to start, yeah, moving things into, you know, new paradigms if he really, you know, has major changes that he wants to make.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
I believe you've talked to Joe Vavra as well, too. And I thought one of the key things that came out, you know, this offseason was the fact that, you know, Jake Rogers obviously made some swing adjustments, went and worked with Doug Lotta, who's a really, you know, well-regarded hitting coach. And Joe Vavra really seemed to engage really well in that process and didn't try to thwart it in any way and wanted to participate in it. And I thought that kind of collaborative, you know, attitude is what the Tigers need to see from, you know, not only the new guys, but the people who are already there, or they're all going to end up having to go bye-bye. So, yeah, did you have, you know of Jake Rogers. What were your impressions of Jake Rogers and sort of how that swing change worked out? Maybe that'll kind of get us into the topic in another angle.
Yeah, obviously Jake was kind of looking for a way to kind of break through, for a way to become a major league hitter. He went and found Doug Lotta on his own. That wasn't Joe Vavra setting him up or anything, but he started working with Doug, and Joe was receptive to that. As you guys probably saw and heard, you know, he finally ditched that leg kick that he's had for probably about a decade. And he looks good this spring. He got that front foot down earlier. He looked to just have a little better command of the bat. To a certain degree, I mean, he probably is who he is as a hitter. You got to like the power potential there. If you can find a way to hit, I don't know, 220, 230, 240 in the majors with a solid walk rate, you know, they'll probably be okay with that. And I think Jake is just trying to get more consistent, quiet his swing down a little bit. You saw some progress. Joe Vavra, I think, definitely deserves some credit for being able to work with a guy like Doug Lotta, who, for anyone who doesn't know, a private hitting instructor out in California, has worked with a lot of good players. I think Mookie Betts, a few other guys that worked with Doug Lotta.
Yeah.
But Vavra, at the same time, he's still an old school guy, right? He's not coming in, you know, he's still a line drives, hit the ball hard type of guy. He's not like somebody who's going to be a hitting coach for the Dodgers or for the Astros.
He's that captain launch angle.
yeah, not at all. But he is more open-minded than probably a Lloyd McClendon, probably more knowledgeable on the modern game than some other guys out there. So it's kind of an interesting blend. The Tigers are kind of all about that blend right now, for better or for worse. I think Joe has a lot of good traits. At the same time, the way he teaches hitting at the major league level will still be rooted in the old school a little bit, but he says he's really open to working with a guy like Kenny Graham, right? And that's really the key. The key is the guys coming up.
Yeah.
And how are they to develop as hitters? What will their hitting approach be like? And so as long as there's not a pushback from the major league level on down, then you're getting yourself in a better position to develop some good hitters.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting to think about, you know, who is being impacted more by this. Is it the hitters you know, losing reps because hitting, you know, is a reactive sport or a reactive part of the game and not something that you can really simulate as easily as you can just go throw and throw your stuff and track it. Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question to think about as well. Yeah.
It's a hell of an argument. I mean, really, I would love to listen to, you know, both sides of this because, look, hitting is very difficult. Hitting premium velocity. You're not hitting premium velocity in spring training. Maybe you are in the last 10 days, but you're not, for the most part, you're not facing highly intense premium velocity.
Yeah. Unless you're out there against Tarek's. Yeah, unless you're facing Tarek Skubal or something. Yeah.
Right. For one at bat, or you know what I'm saying, though. But yeah. I mean, even again, Moreno was dropping 100.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but my point is, the other side of this is look, pitchers, they were only just getting to the point in time where they were going to start going through an order the second time.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, arm health is, as we quickly found out this spring training, arm health's a big deal, dude. I mean, it's there's a lot of money sitting in somebody's office getting TJ so far this year. So,
yep.
We didn't even get into the shoulder impingement problems yet, which I'm sure were coming soon. So, it's, you know, this is going to be a huge baseball has, you know, for pitchers, this is going to be. I'd be piggybacking pitchers for such a long time. I'd be piggybacking pitchers for the first 40 games of any season they were even remotely going to attempt to play, and then maybe, yeah, later I'd start stretching guys out a little bit more. But, I mean, they could do weird stuff. They could say, hey, maybe what we'll do, you know, I tell you what, we all grew up playing it this way. There's nothing wrong with playing seven-inning baseball games, man. I'm telling you, it's a whole different idea,
yeah.
Too. I mean, I gave that some thought, and imagine how much that would change the game. You know, people complain that relievers have started to dominate the game of baseball way too much. Want to change the game of baseball? Make the game 7 innings, not 9 innings. I wonder what would happen then. It's a very out-of-the-box thought, and people will yell and scream, but I got news for you. It's you change the game because now all of a sudden you're probably using one reliever, maybe two.
Right.
The guys pitching complete games again, not as much wear and tear on their arms. Totally different game. It's much more of a sprint. Take those 2 innings out of the game. So
yeah, although it's kind of working out that way anyway. Even at 9 innings, you know. I mean, if you cut that down, then you just get all relievers as opposed to, you know, a team with two kind of more traditional starters and then a whole bunch of, you know, kind of mid-range guys who can go through the order one time and then the relievers. I don't know. I mean, we might get to that point regardless of what the inning, you know, length for the game is. Yeah.
I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but it's a weird, there's some weird ideas that you could, I mean, if they play doubleheaders and made them 7 innings, it's a weird experiment, isn't it?
Yeah.
They do it in the minor leagues all the time. They do it in Double A, for heaven's sake. It's not like they,
sure.
You know, it's not unheard of. So it'll be interesting to see. Last thing, Code, I know you had a lead before you got to see it, you know, and I DM'd you a few times about it, and I talked to Brandon about this a little bit, but I wanted to drop this in because you were there to see it. Mize really seemed to polish that cutter up quite a bit. That's a heck of a cutter he was throwing this spring out. I mean, that was a game changer of a pitch for him. And now he's got finger pressure, and he gets, you know, arm side run with a two seamer the other way. And he I don't think he threw a four seam fastball that was just, you know, fell higher. If he was throwing four seam, it was up at the letters or above. It was some nasty stuff, man. That was a total game changer, that stuff I saw from him.
Yeah, that's the beauty of Casey Mize, man. In my time around these pitching prospects, I really haven't seen, not that I've seen them all a ton, I really haven't seen Mize totally dominate an outing like I have Manning and Skubal. But you see Mize make these tweaks. He's so smart. He's so advanced. Right now he's working a high cutter. He's got a four-seam fastball. He's got a two-seam. He can change speeds. He can attack you so many different ways. And he gets it, right? He was smart enough to know I would guess he had some coaches who helped, but I would guess it was mostly his decision to say, I'm going to start pitching up in the zone. I'm going to challenge guys up with this cutter, right? Play that off the slider, the curve, whatever. That's Casey Mize. This guy's an advanced pitcher, and that's what's going to serve him well at the major league level. When things get tough and he has to make adjustments at the major league level, he's going to be able to do it. There's probably more in that bag of tricks, right, where this cutter came from. But man, right now, yeah, it was good. And he had that one spring training start where he really flashed it and looked pretty dominant.
I'm telling you, it was... I mean, it went for, I had my reservations, and, you know, I think Brandon and I have talked about this on podcast many times. We both had some reservations about Casey Mize because I just didn't see his fastball as a swing and miss pitch. I just didn't. And I think it's been proven out that he struggled with it against advanced hitting many a time. And when he added that cutter and basically, you know, limited his straight four-seam fastball usage to up in the zone, tunneling it with other stuff, and, you know, diminished its usage, but
yeah, more cleverly it's just a chase,
sequenced it.
Yeah, it became a chase pitch. Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, now I'm going, oh, yeah, this, I can see the guy's going to eventually be a one or a two, but now the question starts becoming, can he have the durability when he gets to 80 innings to do it for another 60 or 70 innings? I'm never going to see him as a 200 inning pitcher, but
it's still a big question for sure.
Yeah.
I think that he's the type of guy that other pitchers, they may not emulate, but they probably will ask him enough questions that the knowledge will spread through a staff to those that are curious about those things. I mean, everybody is not going to be overly curious about pitch design. I'd love to think they would be, but I do think that his contemporaries and probably even some veterans, there'll be more of a dialogue on a staff now about how can I improve my pitch, you know, my sequencing, what my pitches look like.
Yeah, I think that's all.
I tweak my movement.
Yeah, that's all coming for sure. And I think you see that, you know, you already see that with Matt Boyd, you know, working with Norris a little bit, taking Tark Skubal to Driveline. You know, he's sort of the guru at the major league level, and it does feel like Casey Mize is the one at the minor league level. You know, I mean, I watched just about every start of his last year for once he got to Erie, and even the no-hitter, the cutter was the better pitch. You know, he didn't really use the four-seamer in the zone all that much, even in that outing, which, you know, for someone who watches a ton of pitching, you have to get used to that, because my initial reaction is like, man, he does not trust his fastball. And then eventually you get to the point where you're like, oh, he just doesn't really need his fastball. That's crazy.
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
So, and it's even, you know, but I'm saying that cutter went from a 55 pitch to a 70 pitch this spring to me.
Yeah, last year it was like 90, 91 with a little bit of depth. And after you kind of pointed that out to me, I started, you know, watching the outings this spring. And, yeah, it was more like 92, 93 with a little bit of ride and cut together. Yeah, it was wild.
It was so late, and it was so nasty, okay?
It was really late. It was like the Greg Maddux, the last 10 inches of movement is all that matters.
Yeah. You know,
that's like that. Oh.
I think Pitching Ninja has a Rivera gift that been up the last few days on Mariano's cutter, and you watch it, and that's exactly what it is. It's the last 6 feet. It's the last 5 inches of break, and it's like he could have stood on the mound, shook the ball at you, turned his hand over and showed you the grip and went, here it comes, and you still couldn't hit it, you know? So, yeah, that was something that was very, very interesting to me about Mize. And, you know, God knows I criticize a lot of what they do down there a lot, but I will, and I've criticized Mize a lot, but I was extremely encouraged and impressed by what I saw from that. More than anything. I mean, otherwise, and it was fun to see Riley Green. It's great. It was a PR dream for the Tigers, but I don't get too excited about hitting in the first 2.5 weeks of spring training. The guys are
no, But I don't think either one of but I don't think either of us is really worried about, you know, Riley Green's development, you know, as a general, you know, subject in general. Like, he's going to be a major league player. You know, it's just a question of how good he gets. And, you know, the more you see, you know, clips of him like working out and doing box jumps and see like the actual athleticism he possesses as well as the hitting ability. Yeah, I'm feeling real good there.
Yeah, I think you got to love the approach. He has that arrogance that really great players have that belies age. Age is almost becomes irrelevant. And to take that many walks, to work counts, to, you know, it will, he put it this way. The boy wasn't afraid. It can, you know, and that's a big part of the battle, man. He wasn't afraid in the least. So
I was going to say, I think you're right. For as much as I love analytics, for as much as it's way too easy to get caught up in prospects, and we've seen that in the Tigers organization, you know, for years now. I've been around enough of these guys now where sometimes you can just tell, right? And I don't know, man. I feel like you can just tell with Riley Green. He's got a certain magical quality to him. I don't want to predict what his major league career will be like, because who really knows, but I have a feeling he's going to be successful, maybe as much as any of these kids. He's just got that quality about him.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he has that knack for just showing out when it counts, too. You know, there's just that little extra that someone like a... I mean, you can see it all across sports, but it's just those people who really, really savor the big moment, savor being in the spotlight a little bit more than most, never are hiding from the ball. So, yeah, I think we got a good one there. I don't want to, you know, just... you know, drag Cody throughout the entire minor league roster, but I do have a couple more. You know, we'd like to talk about the majors a little bit more too. But did you happen to get a chance to see Matt Manning's developing slider at all? Because that's probably the one pitch in the entire system that I'm most curious about right now.
Yeah, it's very much developing.
Yeah,
it's a work in progress. I think I only saw it once, that first bullpen. He was working on it, and it was everywhere. It was in the dirt. He was not happy. He kind of, you know, cursed under his breath after a couple errant sliders, and that was when Rick Anderson was like, stop worrying about that for today. And then I believe I saw him go back to it one other time, and he was spotting it, but it didn't really look like it was moving a whole lot. So very early on in that developmental stage, I would guess he might need another... You know, this break maybe is the best for him. Maybe it's Matt Manning. Maybe Matt Manning's going to come back from this break and he's going to figure out the slider. I mean, who knows?
Yeah,
I was going to say he needs another full off season or something, but he's getting an extra off season right now. So a work in progress. I really think Matt Manning needs a third pitch like that. The fastball is there. The curveball is there. The changeup, you know, not a bad pitch, but I think a legitimate slider is what he's going to need to really thrive at the major league level. So we'll see how it comes along.
Yeah.
I did like when I saw him touch 100.
Yeah, that was nice too.
My gun might have been a little hot, but I hadn't seen him do that before.
That gun was a little juiced all spring, personally, but I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, I think we've all kind of expected that at, you know, at development, you know, once he's done, he's going to be able to hit 100. I mean, yeah. So that was nice to see. You know, I won't say it wasn't nice to see, even though, yeah, you assume it's a little bit fraudulent and it was probably 98 that he was hitting. But yeah, you know, I just think he's going to get there. But the other thing about Manning is that every year he just looks a little bit more strong, a little bit bigger, you know, just a little, there's always just like a little bit more of everything every year. And that's the thing with him, is that the aptitude is so good that I just continue to have, you know, huge confidence that he's going to be able to find that third pitch and put it all together. So we'll see. I mean, I totally agree about the slider. Like, Mark and I have talked about this since the beginning, that he was going to eventually have a slider or a cutter. And I've seen him throw really good changeups for, like, lengthy stretches of games and mix it in pretty effectively. And it just kind of died out on him last summer. He didn't really have the good curveball all the time last summer. Kind of seemed like maybe he got a little bit worn down with that. But as we've seen, you know, you don't need a changeup in the modern game if you can develop a good slider and a curveball. If you've got two different breaking balls, he'll just use the curveball as his off-speed pitch against lefties, and it won't matter that much. So, but yeah, that's definitely going to be a pitch that will be key to his development one way or the other. He's going to need that extra.
I think he will benefit from his time in AAA, more sophisticated hitters. You know, Manning is obviously, you know, Brandon, you and I have been on the record. We've been Manning advocates for quite some time before it was that popular. But I think he can use the failure to help polish his game here, and I think he'll get some of that in AAA's. You know, you make mistakes in AAA, you get yourself in trouble pretty quick. Put it this way, it's not like AA isn't good. There's just more, the quantity of good hitters in AAA is greater. So
yeah, inexperienced, an experienced hitter.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So I think that Manning will benefit from the competitive level of AAA, and he needs that. He can get away in AA throwing fastballs, you know, almost at will, and mixing in an occasional, 12-6. But I think in AAA he's going to have to be better than what he was in AA. Yeah. And I think he needs to polish.
Yeah, I mean, I think he needs to fail probably more so than Miser Scoobal does. You know, he needs to get hit a little bit and kind of see what he's actually going to need to do, because it's been fairly easy for him, thus far. He has the occasional game where he get hit, but yeah, he could just throw his way out of almost anything all the way through the AA level. So, you know, get used to dealing with runners on base. Like he's worked on all that stuff. Like his pickoff move is a lot better. He's way more aware than he was, you know, 2 years of what's 2 years ago of what's going on around him. You know, he's altered his delivery to hide the ball better. To avoid tipping. I've seen him do a few things on that front, like, you know, holding his glove closer to himself. There's all these little details that move, but yeah, he could probably use to get hit around a little bit more than most would.
Cody, did you see anything down there that was kind of under the radar that you kind of liked? Any players that you kind of liked that you saw a little something from, or before we move back up to the major league part of it?
As I told you earlier, it's so weird. It feels like it was a lifetime ago. I mean, obviously we've recapped all the major guys. Obviously Scoobles, the talk of camp, and was really amazing. Franklin Perez had a couple outings where he looked really good. I'm trying to think if there are any like position guys under the radar who
did you see Derek Hill or Daz at all? Any thoughts on either of the two of them?
Man, I like Daz Cameron a lot. I think he's a really fun guy to talk to. You gotta love his tools, but his swing looks long to me.
And
that was a problem for him last year, and it did not look as though it had improved. I mean, his hands were long to the ball, and I don't know that you have to be a lot more scientific like that for a guy with his build. I think he needs to shorten up the stroke a little bit, and we're now looking at a pretty prolonged period of time where he's been a little out of sorts, and his hand path isn't great. Derek Hill looked like he's always looked, and I've only seen him since last year when he had developed a little more pop in his swing. He's been in the minors long enough. I think he is what he is at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if he eventually gets a shot at the big league level, but he's going to be a high strikeout guy. He's not going to be a guy who gets on base at a very high clip. If he can continue to build on the power a little bit and, you know, there's an injury or something, maybe he can hang for a little bit, just mostly because of the defense. But I don't think there are any major changes that I noticed with Hill this spring.
It kind of feels like, yeah, like, you know, a Jacoby Jones outcome is kind of the most likely scenario, yeah.
No, that might be best case scenario, honestly.
We didn't talk about this. Cody, I don't know if I told you this because I saw it in, I mean, they sent us some pictures, but I... the weird benefit of spring training is of actually the delay of the season starting is, you know, once Perez had a broken leg and no one said a damn word about it.
So. I did, that might have happened after I had already left, and I was scheduled to go back down there 2 days after spring training got canceled, so I never got to look into that. And that's, you know, it's you would like to think the Tigers would have just made it public that, you know, top 30 prospect has a broken leg, but they didn't. And
yeah,
stuffed away on the backfield the whole time. And once games are going on, it's very easy for no one in the media. I mean, it's possible going at one of the major league staff, both the PR staff and Ron Gardenhire had any idea that this dude had a broken leg. That's crazy. I still wish I knew more about that.
You know someone has a broken leg when they have a cast on and they're on a scooter.
Yeah, but how many people would even recognize Wenzel Perez, you know, by his face? So yeah.
I thought it was funny. I mean, it was. You know, no one said a damn word. So I mean, I guess because, you know, minor leaguers weren't reporting till like close to the 15th. So essentially, kind of was flying under the radar, but there were more than enough guys down there. Obviously, they were playing games on the backfield against each other, you know, so it wasn't like it was some huge secret. So, the other thing, Cody, did you get any feel from talking to people of what they were, you know, what their thinking was about what do you guys think about the draft now that it's going to be five rounds? Is that official now or not?
I don't think it's 100% official. Is that correct? It seems like they're kind of aiming for five, but it could still be flexible.
Yeah, they still said Rob Manfred kind of had the discretion to add rounds if he wanted to, was what I read.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure what the scenario would be to add rounds either. It's all still a little weird to me, and it seemed like they just wanted to basically give the appearance that they have a plan in place and do intend to have a draft, even though a lot is still fluid. A lot's already changed again since I was talking to people about it a couple weeks ago. It's kind of a different world now. I think, you know, the good news is it does seem as though they intend to have a draft, but it's going to be weird.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of decisions from a lot of those sort of second, third round type guys. Like, do I go back? Do I just, you know, take what I can get right now? Let alone all the younger guys who are, you know.
I think you're going to see a lot of guys go back. I mean, some of these guys say if you think you're a third-round pick, well, you're probably good enough that you think you'll be a first-round pick if you go back. And you got, you know, for as enticing as the money is, you got an entire season of college baseball taken away from you. And these guys, most of them cherish that experience if they are college players. You know, it's not like all of them, but I think you'll see definitely a higher percentage than normal go back to school.
Yeah, it's
I think so too.
Talking to our resident expert Brian Sikowski, and it is a huge benefit that we do get to talk to Brian, because who sees more players of this ilk than Brian does. What's interesting is he said, man, it's a really, really deep pitching draft, and now you're going to make it five rounds. It changes your thinking about how you might want to go about things. And, you know, I think you're going to find really smart teams are going to have a field day here, and really not so smart teams are going to go, man, again, we got left at the altar above, you know. So this is part of what makes this season so unique. You know, some see opportunity and some see a massive train collision. So it should be interesting to see what happens with this. I would be amazed if they go deeper than five rounds, because from a business standpoint, they've kind of floated that to begin with. And who in their right mind is going to go, yeah, I'll tell you what, let's make it seven rounds and pay those guys in the sixth and seventh round a bunch more money than the $20,000, okay?
Yeah, that's the sticking point, is the fact that they're going to be able to just offer on those guys afterward. Yeah, that really does change things.
Baseball is, like every sport, but, you know, especially baseball, so damn greedy that I find it difficult to believe that they'll do greater than five rounds. And I think it'll make for a pretty interesting college season next year. But
there's going to be a lot of seniors out there. A lot of guys might get their scholarship, you know, bumped or cut. I don't know.
I think I read something last night. There's already 58 kids 58 baseball players in the transfer portal.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's you know, that all is a whole. That's a podcast in itself.
Yeah,
right there.
For sure.
I mean, but it's you know, the Tigers look. I mean, it's. I think I don't know if I had this conversation with you. I had this conversation. I had it with you, B. You know, I was like, I had it with somebody in the last 2 days, and you and I were both pretty big Kalenic guys, and it was like, so if you had a do-over and you said, okay, I mean, I love, you know, look, Mize is, you know, super sexy now. That cutter really is, you know, taking it to another level, but you still have these huge durability questions. So you say to yourself, well, if you would have passed on Mize and taken Kalenic, now you got Green and Kalenic, you got Scooble Manning, okay? And so now, this year, it totally opens up the choice for you because, I mean, Lacy looked pretty amazing for Texas A&M, right? So you could have taken Lacy this year, maybe paid him under slot in a year like this and paid your second and third rounders a lot more money, gone high end, or you could have said, wow, this is a deep pitching draft, so I won't even worry about it, and I'll add Torkelson or I'll add Martin or and you know, it's a goofy ass question because it didn't happen that way, but it does make you ask yourself, kinda, you know, there was a different way to go about it. It's still be very interested to see who they're going to take. I would say that it, you know, for sure now means that it'll be a shocker if they don't take either Torkelson or Martin at this point, right? So,
yeah, I mean,
there's no pop-up guys. I mean, yeah. I like Veen, but you're not taking, look, these guys, they need to start producing. You're not taking another high school kid. I can promise you that at this point. So
I was under the impression it was Spencer Torkelson's pick to lose in spring training, and the cancellation of the college season might have pretty much sealed that.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that helped me with Torkelson, too, was watching him play enough just to see that he probably is athletic enough to play third base, and maybe you could even fake it in, you know, in a corner outfield spot part-time, something like that. That helps me out a little bit. But, yeah, without more information and, you know, and seeing these guys, you know, play into April and May, it's really hard to think that they're going to do much else, yeah, other than take Martin or Torkelson. And I would probably bet Torkelson, even though Martin in a certain sense seems like the kind of like Tigers type player, like more of a high average line drive type hitter who they could maybe play at shortstop, maybe play at center field, although I still don't know about that either. So yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna bet Torkelson. And I'll leave my feelings out of it. I just think that's what they're probably most likely to do. It just sucks, you know, to have the first round pick though, and then to not have the opportunity to take the guys that you would want, you know, in the sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, you know. But you'd hate to lose, you know, those opportunities, unfortunately. But it's just the way it's going. And I'm sure every team in the league has a story they can tell about how this is worse for them than everybody. So, you know, that's the way those things work out. Cody, when you left spring training, I'll just put it this way, how did you feel about the 2020 Tigers? Like, did you have any kind of, you know, like vibe for yourself as to whether or not you thought this team was going to be markedly better than last year? I think we'd all assume that they're going to win more games just because it's hard not to. But did you feel, you know, kind of a vibe that you liked the team better? What were your kind of impressions when you left?
Spring training was so odd because I told people when I left, it was like, oh yeah, there's a major league team. I left Lakeland with a quite a bit better feeling about the state of the Tigers organization. Okay. At the major league level, though, almost forgot, and that was kind of a testament to how good Tarik Skubal and Riley Green and Casey Mize and those guys were. They kind of dominated the show, and especially when we weren't quite to, you know, formulating the major league roster, making cuts and all that, a lot of that stuff was still in the background. A lot of those guys were still kind of rounding into game shape. So I didn't really have a strong vibe one way or another. I think, like everyone thinks, yeah, they'll win more games. There was nothing that made me gave me, you know, great confidence about the Tigers at the major league level this season or anything that I would expect to be way different. I think maybe Daniel Norris would be the biggest thing. Norris and Turnbull. I mean, I think the rotation minus Zimmerman could be, wasn't bad at times last year and could be pretty good this year if guys like Norris and Turnbull take another step forward. Overall, it's just the minor leagues dominated the talk every day, and it was hard for that not to be the case.
Yeah, and that, that's just probably where we're gonna be at for a while, apart from other than those guys making their debuts. But yeah, I thought the same, like, the rotation could be better, and then you might look at, you know, later on in the summer, you might get, you know, Scooble or Mize up if there's an injury or something like that, and have something to watch there, and overall put up pretty good numbers. But yeah, it just feels like it just feels like sort of a never-ending rebuild. Like it's felt to a lot of us like they've been rebuilding, you know, basically since 2014. So yeah, it just still a long way to go in the process.
Hey, listen, when they start spring training up again, I'm gonna send you a note that I want you to quietly slip to Al Avila, and on it says, "Hey, in 2020 baseball, the bullpen is super prioritized, and it really makes sense to have a good bullpen if you have any possibility of winning. So you may want to work on this." I mean, just don't. I don't want to be mean to him, and I call him enough names, and I'm sure his burner account reads what I say. But you know, their bullpen is such a dumpster fire, and it's like, oh my god, do you understand how you play baseball in 2020? It's come on.
Yeah, I think it's just hasn't really been a priority, and I think that tells you obviously that they don't view themselves as anywhere close to contention. Why waste resources on the bullpen? That, or you could probably insert some joke about learning from Dave Dombrowski. One of those two things.
And the other thing too is you just, you know, unless you're in a position to win, you know, the bullpen becomes like a place where you try out all your other arms who aren't your stud top prospects. The problem is that you never find guys that you can deal away. And as we've seen, that's like the only commodity that's really, you know, outsized in value right now at a trade deadline or in that kind of scenario is the relievers. And it's unfortunate. I mean, I'm sure we could have seen a scenario where Joe Jimenez or Buck Farmer had a pretty good first half and got dealt away, but pretty hard to see either one of them, you know, drawing any kind of a major haul either at this point. So
at what point in time, and you know, look, I like a lot of things about Joe Jimenez, and I've been pretty vocal about this, especially this spring, but at what point in time does somebody take Joe aside and go, "Joe, look, here's the deal. Until you learn how to do two things. One, throw a slider for a strike for strike one. Nobody is waiting for your slider on strike one. It's like when you're 13 years old, and if you can spin, the easiest thing once kids start learning how to spin a baseball when I coached was, look, you don't have to throw it a lot. The easiest time to throw it is the first pitch of a sequence. Yeah. Throw it right over to the damn plate if you can. They're taking it. It's strike one. What you get is strike one, and what you also get is they at least think that you have it, okay?
Yeah, sure.
And Joe Jimenez's slider is just, it's terrible. No one honors it. As a hitter, as a major league hitter, you don't have to honor it because it's never – I watched very specifically this spring as he'd come in for these one-inning outings. I'm not sure he threw a strike with his slider for – the five outings that I saw him this spring, he did not throw one single strike with his slider. Not one.
This is a whole topic because I everything about his fastball screams that he should have a knuckle curveball. And when he throws his the best version of his slider, it looks like a knuckle curveball. But then the rest of the time it's just crap and it's just in the dirt, like over and over and over again, and nobody even, you know, everybody just spits at it and it's not even a factor. Yeah, I know.
It's so what I would say to him, look.
That's okay. A good fastball, though.
It's a really good fastball. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Every other hitter, we're going to spin the first pitch right in the middle of the plate for a strike. Okay? Because I promise you, nobody's looking for it then. And it all of a sudden it's strike one and they got to honor it. It's just amazing to me that a Major League Baseball team, with all the data they have and all the savvy they have and all the know-how they have this guy that is fastball 95% of the time is really good. 5% of the time it ends up being a souvenir for a fan when he goes home. At least it did last year. Okay. Major league hitters know that he doesn't have a breaking pitch that they even need to pay attention to. And it's awful hard existing on just the fastball. Even I was watching the 2016 Cubs Cleveland when the Cubs won the World Series 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I watched the last two innings of that yesterday morning. It was still quite great. And even knowing what was coming. And I'm watching Chapman throw that. And it's like he was throwing 101. They were hitting it because they knew they didn't have to honor anything else. And until he started spinning a few, it's obviously he had pitched, every day for the last 30 days, it felt like, in that series. But my point is that this is part of player development. And there's some really weird things that go on down there that I just shrug my shoulders and go, well, I wonder. Take a guy like Jimenez, if he went to Tampa, all right? Tampa is – I had a long talk with Jason Hanselman about Tampa Bay last week on my pod, and we were just laughing about how they optimize relievers, and it is an amazing thing what they are able to figure out. Imagine if Joe Jimenez went to Tampa. You're going to tell me he would be – not a lot better.
Right. Well, and it's not even just figuring it out. Like, I think we both agree, like, there are some people in the Tigers organization who probably recognize this. It's getting everyone to buy into it in advance. Like, the idea in the Tigers organization that you would take a guy who's, a middling, solid reliever with potential for more, like Joe Jimenez, and say to him, okay, you're in the major leagues, now we want you to throw a completely different breaking ball. That's the kind of thing that a team that totally trusts its data and its ability to teach you that will go ahead and do far more aggressively than a team that, has kind of this weird mishmash of approaches, and then all of a sudden you're in the major leagues and you've got, one coach, and now you've got Rick Anderson's your new coach, and Rick Anderson is a sinker, slider, pitch-to-contact type guy who probably is, like, perfectly happy to just see you pound the zone with fastballs because that's your best pitch. I don't know.
I mean, Cody, that's the kind of stuff that I wish that if I was down there doing what you're doing on the backfield,
Mark would get thrown the hell out of almost immediately.
That may be true, but you would be amazed that probably I would be more interested that I would just be standing there absorbing it, watching and seeing what was being done. I may write about it later and have certain people be very upset about it, like a good friend of mine encountered last year. but I would say to you, it's look, somebody needs to say to Joe Jimenez, hey, Joe, look, here's the deal. On a really good team, I don't care what you think, but I can tell you right now, professionally, you're probably a seventh inning guy on a really good team until you prove you're better than what you are right now. And until you can learn how to spin a baseball to get people out, you're a seventh inning guy, okay? You want to keep making $565,000 a year? God bless you. You want to learn how to make $5 to $10 million a year? Here's how you're going to have to learn how to do it. And I don't know, a guy like that, from all appearances, he seems like he's a pretty willing pupil. He seems like he wants to be good. So if you approached him correctly, I'm sure he'd be very interested in what you had to say. So, those are the kind of guys that the Tigers, Joe Jimenez, this is going to be season 4 in the major leagues, if I'm not incorrect, right? It's not his this will be his third full season. And I'm not sure.
No, it's his. This will be his fourth. Well, this would have been his fourth full season.
Yeah. So
24 games in 17.
So I don't know how many. Oh, okay. I don't know how many days that he used. So I got a feeling he's probably still got 3 more years of control left. So, but the point is, they need to start optimizing him while he still has value. Okay, if you're going to deal him, great. But maybe your team's going to be good, and you're going to keep him. But the point is, it's about time he started taking the next step.
Yeah, it's about time you try something. Yeah, you don't just keep doing the same thing. I mean, this is the subject you and I talk about over and over, is the passivity. You know, just the willingness to just sort of play out the string until there's no choice but to make a move or to do something. And that seems to plague the Tigers, you know, quite a bit. We've seen that in contract negotiations. We saw that play out with Nick Castellanos and we'll just kind of wait and see how it goes, and maybe somehow he'll be worth more, you know, with 3 months of control than he did with two. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot of just sort of waiting and watching, and not as much proactivity as maybe we would like to see. Obviously, you've got to do it well, too. That's the other part of it. But, yeah. But this is where we just get Cody in trouble. I can't have Cody on here screaming about how the Tigers are passive and weak.
Yeah. Right, we've already gotten enough people in trouble doing this, right?
Yeah.
Brandon and I. So, Code, what have you been watching on Netflix?
Yeah, let's go into this.
All right, quarantine time. Started Ozark. Finished season one of that. Pretty good. I think the best comparison I heard, kind of like a poor man's Breaking Bad. Good show. I don't know that it's, you know, an all-time great or anything, but a good binge watch during the quarantine, so that's been the most recent one. What about you guys?
I watched Bosch. You guys ever watch Bosch?
No.
Amazon Prime. Titus Welliver. It's actually really, really good. I think he's a homicide detective. It's very good. It grows on you. Well worth watching. Kind of an underrated show. I like that. I like Ozark. I'm through the third season. I have not watched the Tiger.
Tiger King.
I have not watched the Tiger thing. If somebody told me that the Tiger took a big bite out of somebody and they had it on there, it might have encouraged me a little more. But I've heard that it's pretty out there. So most people seem to have, at least the entertainment value has been pretty good. But I have not ventured into that yet.
It's a strange watch. It's a whole experience more than it is a show. I mean, it is, every episode is just weird. One of those car wreck type deals. You kind of want to look away, but you just can't. Disappointed you guys haven't seen it, though, because having lived in Oklahoma for 6 years, a lot of background on Joe Exotic. There's a thing on Twitter: if you lived in Oklahoma, you're max 2 degrees separated from someone who could have thrived working at the GW Zoo. Turns out I know a guy who his aunt sold Joe Exotic a bear. So, you know, he was, I knew with Joe Exotic long before the rest of the country did. Crazy stuff.
You did see he grew up in Lansing, right?
Oh, really?
I had no idea. I thought he grew up in Texas.
I'm telling you, I was reading it. In fact, supposedly went to the same middle school as Graham Couch. How do you like that? So... You might want to talk to Graham about that and find out what's up. I think they might. I don't know if they were almost overlapping when they were there at the same time. So I did read a few reasonably. You know, Couch is reasonably humorous anyway. So there were a few exchanges about that stuff. And I'll tell you another underrated. You know, they only did like 2 seasons of it, but you guys ever watch Flaked or no?
No, I haven't seen that one.
On Netflix, yeah, it's good. It's about a guy in Venice hanging out, kind of like a bum. It's pretty good. It's well done. So
nice. I'm watching a whole bunch of weird European movies that I meant to catch up on, and for some reason when I'm on like a vacation or like when I'm off an extended period, it feels like I go back to things more than I would watch anything new. I might have to watch Tiger King just because it feels like I already have the entire gist and know who all the people are and everything. But yeah, I'm over here watching like The Wire first 2 seasons. I've done that. I rewatched all the MCU movies, which left me like less than thrilled with them by the time it was over. I probably should have just left it as it was. But yeah, I'm doing that. I watched The Witch not too long ago, so I went back and checked out The Witch. Watched True Detective season one again. All the old standbys here, really. Doing that. I'm still, I reread Dune. So yeah, that's how it's going over here. I'm just I'm basking in my comfort food, I guess.
Well, I do a good bit of that too. I can honestly be a kind of a TV snob, right? So if something's bad, you know, I don't want to watch it. So I've rewatched a little bit of The Wire, rewatched season one and two of Mad Men, which is probably my all-time favorite show. So
I should
going back to some of the hits too.
That's what I should do. I saw the first two seasons of Mad Men, and then I just petered out on it. I should go back and check out the full rest of that.
It's good, B. Go watch that. You'll like that.
I might have to watch Tiger King just because someone described it as if, how do they put it? They said it was like if Werner Herzog, you know, made some kind of like reality TV show about crazy, you know, crazy people who own a, you know, a illegal zoo. And I was like, oh, all right, well, maybe I would watch that. Yeah. They're like, so I felt the same way as they watch Grizzly Man, you know, or something like that.
So it's not the Matt Damon if we had a zoo, then that's what you're telling me, right?
No, I think that's a different ball of wax.
Okay, so, and lastly, so, you know, Brandon and I talk about music all the time. Brandon plays guitar. I pretend I play guitar. So what kind of, you know, you're being from Oklahoma, I think you and I exchanged a few things, you know, so tell me what you've been listening to, Code.
Yeah, I probably need to broaden the music horizons too, but just going through old stuff, Jason Isbell, who's released a few new songs, had a really good Rolling Stone interview, a couple days ago, and then back through some 70s stuff, even though that was way before my time. That was kind of my dad's era, so, got a few old albums a few years ago, got really into 70s stuff. I mean, Tom Petty, kind of the likes of that. So, yeah. That's kind of what I've been playing.
That's a good rabbit hole, Tom. Tom Petty's a good rabbit hole.
Yeah, for sure. Like all the 70s, like the 70s and 60s music is just great. Like I'm not old enough for that to have been the stuff I grew up with, but yeah, I'm the type who searches backwards as much as I do look for anything that's current. I like to let the culture sift everything for like a year or two, and then I go back and look at like, what was the best album in retrospect in, you know, 2018 or 2017? Then I'll go like look through those lists. But you know, the stuff that's hot a lot of times isn't the stuff that, you know, even like a year or two later anyone's still thinking or, you know, listening to. So yeah, I tend to mind the past on all those things a little bit as well.
Listen, Code, the 70s was a rich, diverse decade of music. I think about like, you know, decades that came after, and there, I mean, put it this way, the 80s was just the worst for music. In this, meanwhile, the 70s, you could start early in the 70s, like when I was in the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, which was before, you know, you were even thought of, Cody, and, you know, B, I think you were probably running around doing God knows what, but you were pretty small, so,
yep.
You know, like 72, I was going through, you know, a few dives on some of this stuff, and I, you know, big album for me was Every Picture Tells a Story. It was Rod Stewart and the Faces, which is a great album, by the way, which is Ron Wood and Rod Stewart at their peak.
Yeah, the Faces are good. That I know. Yeah.
And you know, but it, you know, that's the start of the decade. Now, at the end of the decade, you had both, you know, the best Elvis Costello albums, which were, you know, just phenomenal. Some, you know, probably his best stuff. You also had The Clash just starting to come out.
Yeah, the Talking Heads were out. Television, yeah, Patti Smith, sure.
I told B that I was going to tell this story, but I went to a Clash concert at the State Theater downtown. I think it might have been like 80 or 81. Held about 3,000 people. Was young, thin, had hair, Mark Gourash. I thought I was cool then, and I ended up literally in the first two rows against the stage, and the crush was so intense because it was a very small venue, and this is peak time of the Clash, that either we were going to die standing where we were, part, they had to pull us up on stage because we were going to get crushed.
Oh, man.
And they did. And it, you know, it's still a pretty good story. Got pulled up on stage at the Clash downtown right when they were just starting to become legendary.
Did you get to hang out on the stage for a little bit and stand 20 feet from Joe Strummer and stuff?
Yeah, we did. But, you know, I was disappointed because Joe was not, you know, he was not calling me up to sing. And it's a little upsetting, but it was still pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
It was the kind of thing after the concert you went, wow, did that just happen to us?
Yeah.
And it did. So, yeah, it was that's a very, very music rich decade. I mean, I'm not even counting multiple Zeppelin albums.
Yeah, yeah.
Multiple Who albums. I mean, they're just,
I'll just say this:
so much stuff in your period.
For the thing about the '80s is that the '80s was the decade when all the good music went underground, and I think we're still kind of there. You know, like some good things break through, but it's just all a little bit more underground. You know, it just became a lot more commercialized, and there were a lot less sort of like independent radio stations in the '80s. There's a ton of good bands in the '80s. It's just that almost none of them got played anywhere but college radio. So that's just the way it goes.
This is right in the Brandon Day wheelhouse, because, you know, for me, it's like, you know, besides Thriller and Appetite for Destruction, I mean, it's like, you know, it kind of thinned out. There was a lot of hair bands. There was, like, you know, not one of the best decades for music. Obviously, the 90s were a ton better. The other thing I was going to tell you guys, we're talking about Netflix. I've always liked Amy Winehouse, but I went down and Brandon and I have been known to talk to each other at 2:30 in the morning sometimes, especially these last few weeks. And I'd gone down an Amy Winehouse, you know, music rat hole, and there's some ridiculously great stuff. And it ended up the next day I watched the documentary on Netflix, and it brings a whole side to her that first of all, it's musical genius, to say the least. But when you watch it, you get to see her play guitar and how she created music and how fame just ate her alive. And it's kind of tragic, but it's pretty interesting because she was very, very unique. There's a part where she sings with Tony Bennett. And
oh, yeah.
So obviously two of the greatest jazz singers in the history of song, and I would recommend that to somebody, even if they didn't know her. It's pretty difficult to notice genius, and it's well worth. It's not a short doc. It's 2 hours, but
I gotta hand it
very, very, very.
Yeah, that sounds good. That's something I should check out. You know, I got to hand it to Tony Bennett, because anybody who wants to is listening to this can go YouTube Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett or Amy Winehouse and Tony Bennett and see a completely different side of either one of them than you'd ever imagine. That Lady Gaga Tony Bennett thing is just wild to me, because it's just not what you would expect from her, and she just fucking crushes it.
Oh, she is.
She's a talented one. Yep.
She's super talented, to say the least. It's. I mean, as weird as she's, you know, some of the stuff that she started, I mean, there's not many people that can
wear a meat dress.
Yeah. But you're not many musicians can sit down at a piano and belt out what she does.
Yep.
With no accompaniment, and it's just pretty. It's pure genius, to say the least. So.
As a big Bjork fan, I can just say, you know, it just always seems to work out this way, that the best ones are always, like, the strangest and the least, like, explicable in a lot of ways. That's just the way it is, yeah. Seems to be.
So, Mark, you said you've been listening to some Chris Stapleton. And...
Yeah, I did. When I would go down these YouTube, you know, wormholes a few times, I had seen him, and I could, you know, he sings so beautifully. He plays beautifully, but then when I did a little homework, I realized that before he became mainstream popular, he had written so much music for other people, right? Yeah. And it's just you know, it's pretty almost pretty unparalleled. And I figured out what the deal was. Obviously, things with his wife, and he's just so damn good. And I think I said to you, Code, that, you know, a lot of when I when I started to listen to country music a little bit more lately, and even my son, who's 29, we were both, he started to listen, you know, he's got a pretty diverse musical taste also. And, you know, what you listen to in a lot of country music now, there's a whole part of it that would have in the 70s and the early 80s would have been considered rock and roll, just with southern, you know, southern rock and roll. And it's now all country. So it's kind of absorbed it, and it's, you know, it's still huge. It's just kind of marketed slightly differently. But you know, I've gotten back into some of that. Chris Stapleton is amazing. I listen to some Casey Musgraves.
You're still on that Tedeschi Trucks train, aren't you?
Okay,
good.
I told that to Cody today. I mean, that's basically just that's a more evolved and just an amazing, you know, next evolution of Allman Brothers stuff.
It's like the Exotic Blues or something, you know.
Susan Tedeschi, an American treasure, dude. I mean, come on.
I saw Derek Trucks play a show with his trio when he was like 18, and I had no idea who he was. He was opening for the Tragically Hip, and he just like tore our faces off. You know, we were in the second row, and I didn't know who he was. I was like, oh, you know, dude plays slide guitar, that's cool. And he just went off, you know, for like an hour and a half, playing like John Coltrane shit that I knew. He was amazing.
That's a great wormhole to go down to. Yeah. The Dusky Trucks is just, you're just like, even though you're not familiar with the music sometimes, you're just watching their execution of it, and you're going, oh my God, these people are so crazy talented. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's kind of like Riley Green, you know, there's that little bit of casualness, you know, while all this genius is just pouring at you so casually, you know, that's when you just know, you know, it's like Prince, like combing his hair while still playing the solo with one hand, you know, that kind of shit, just like, oh, man.
By the way, one of the few good things of the 80s, Prince.
Oh, sure.
but I would tell you, when I was in the middle of the night and I was doing some Tedeschi Trucks, and they did a song, I forget which song it was, and it was impromptu, and it was from their damn dressing room, okay? Okay? And they sat in the dressing room and extemporaneously played, and you know, Derek Trucks is just, he's just killing it. I'm going, you know, I would give like three fingers to be able to play like that.
Oh, yeah.
Doing it like it's nothing. It was like watching Miguel Cabrera take batting practice and just launch booms, you know, 470 to right center, and he was doing it like it was nothing. They're just so talented. It's, you know, hopefully people, if you're listening to this podcast, there's some people that maybe you haven't, you know, exposed yourself to musically. These are just some crazy great musicians. It's phenomenal stuff. So take a listen to some of this stuff. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, the Amy Winehouse doc, it blew me away. It was far beyond my expectation of what it was going to be like. So
right on. Yeah, and that's it. We all need, you know, we all need to find this stuff. You know, I just hope that when this is all through, everyone remembers that it was the artist who got you through all this, man.
Say the least.
Yeah.
And, I was going to tell you that the last thing I'll leave you, if you guys might like this, with a little country music, I'm pretty sure that Dan and Shay, well before they were popular, my son Jordan's roommate ended up to be very ensconced in a band. I got to remember what was the band that got Dan and Shay was in. All Time Low. Okay. And, you know, he got to Dan and Shay through that. And I think they slept on the couch in his apartment in Bloomington one weekend before they were very popular. So, and now I think they're about the biggest thing in country music these days. So it never ceases to amaze how, you know, musicians, there are a lot of great musicians out there that are not famous, and then all of a sudden they are famous. So,
yeah.
You know, it's, you never can tell what'll happen. So,
I think the idea of hearing some of these artists before they hit it big, you know, must be pretty fascinating. And to circle back around on Chris Stapleton real fast, I mean, the best live performance I've ever seen was Chris Stapleton, and it was at the BOK Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is actually a fairly big venue. They host, like, NCAA tournament games there and stuff. But it's like, you know, I scored a last-minute cheap ticket top of the stadium, and it's Stapleton and his guitar, and his voice is just carrying to the rafters, and it's amazing. I mean, it's so powerful. Holy shit, like, you gotta listen to this guy. Yeah, you should have seen him here 3 years ago before he got big. Like, right when he first released his Traveler album, and no one had even played it on the radio yet. He played at Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, which is, like, a legendary venue. Think of, like, an Oklahoma version of the Ark in Ann Arbor, except everyone's standing up and drinking beer. But that same ecstasy, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And just the power of his voice rocked, like, Kane's Ballroom. I wasn't there, but I can picture it as, like, this incredible performance when he was still on the rise, but, you know, couldn't play in a bigger venue just yet. It must have been amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what it is. You know, people sometimes come with that, like, oh, you should have seen him before they got big. The point is to see him before they got big, because you get to see him up close. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. They're still hungry, you know? They're hungry, and you're in a little ballroom. Those are the best. Cody, a fan of My Morning Jacket at all?
No, not super familiar.
Okay, that might be so. I don't know. That might be something you like. They're definitely Southern rock oriented. One of my favorite kind of Southern rock style bands of the last 20 years or so. Really good jam band, but also just awesome songwriting and singing. That's a band to look for.
Good. Yeah, I'll just check them out.
And you know, we had Bob Dylan come out with a song. I'm waiting for Willie Nelson to come with some kind of counterpoint to that. We need to get the old masters working on this.
See, you know, I saw Willie Nelson. He was the other night. He was with either Kimmel or Fallon, and he, you know, they've been doing these shows remotely.
Yeah.
And he was on, and he was on for quite a long time. He was on talking for like 15 or 20 minutes, and you know, Willie's got to be like 84, 85 years old now.
I think he's more than that. I think he's well into his 90s, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure though.
Really?
Yeah.
There was a story about him, maybe New York Times, or there was a magazine article about Willie not too long ago that talked about how he's still, you know, still rolling strong, still rolling joints, everything at his age. It was pretty good. I'll have to find it.
Yeah, well,
86 years old. Yeah, he didn't get big until he was like in his late 30s, really, in the late 60s. So yeah, he was kind of a late bloomer, I guess. He was like Chris Stapleton. He was like a hugely famous songwriter in the industry before he ever became like a solo artist that was popular. Yeah,
it's a hell of a life right there, man. I can't wait till they write that book and do that movie. That's just got to be something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance to read a biography of Willie Nelson, yeah, it's a hell of a story. Yep, absolutely. All right, boys. Well, I think we've done our duty for all the baseball fans out there. Hopefully this will give everybody something to listen to and a few things to check out and think about over the coming weeks while we wait for further news and report. So, yeah, thanks a lot for coming on, Cody. Great to talk to you. Keep up the good work. We're all loving your content at The Athletic. Hopefully you'll get back out there before too long.
Hope so.
Yep. And Mark, my buddy.
I'll see you soon.
I'll
see you at 2:30 in the morning. I'll DM you what I'm listening to.
Yep, that sounds like a plan. And you can head over and check out the Don't Call It a Team Build Rebuild or podcast. Are you on the Tigers Minor League Report Network?
It's on Tigers Minor League Report. It's called Don't Call It a Rebuild. Call it a team build.
Oh, that's right. I always mix that up. It's too long, man. Yeah. Sorry.
it is too long, and it's a mouthful, and I'm stuck with it now. But yeah. Hopefully I'll have something coming out in the next couple weeks, and I got a couple good guests lined up. Excited to try to do a couple of these. Wish there was baseball, but I appreciate you having me on, B, and I hope everybody, you know, enjoys what we put together tonight. We tried to talk about a few extra things, and everybody stay safe and try to stay out of the supermarket.
Yeah, stay safe, stay sane. We'll see you on the other side of this thing.
Yeah.